We take a single episode of a science fiction TV series and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. This is the Fusion Patrol Podcast. Welcome to the discussion. Hello and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I am Eugene.
I am Ben.
And we'll be looking at the penultimate episode of the first series of the classic 78-ish TV series Blake 7. This episode is called Deliverance. Servalan is tracking a two-man spacecraft heading towards a secret destination. The ship loses control and explodes around the planet Cephalon, a barbarous world destroyed by war. Nearby, the Liberator sees the ship explode and attempts to save the two occupants who have ejected in survival capsules. Aven leads a search party of Jenna, Villa, and Gan. They find one occupant dead and the other critically injured. They return the survivor to the Liberator, but Jenna doesn't return with them. They return to look for her. On board the Liberator, the wounded man, named Ensor, explains that he must get to the planet Aristo to save the life of his father. He carries power cells that his father needs to survive, and a promise that the Federation has agreed to pay 100 million credits for something called Orak. When Blake refuses to leave until his crew have returned, Ensor takes Callie hostage and forces Blake to head to Aristo. On the planet, which is bathed in deadly radiation, Aven, Villa, and Gan enter a mountain hideout, where Aven is treated as some prophesied god. Migat, the one who has waited for him, explains that her people await someone who can bring about their deliverance. Deliverance comes in the form of a rocket and a gene bank that will restart her people on another world. Aven and the gang get the rocket ready, rescue Jenna, and launch Migat's people back into the stars. On the Liberator, Ensor collapses and dies before they reach Aristo. Blake returns immediately to Cephalon. Meanwhile, at Space Command, Servalan brings in Travis, now disgraced and relieved of his command after his mishandling of the Blake affair, and gives him a chance to redeem himself. He's willing to do anything to get his command back and have another chance to kill Blake. Servalan explains that she agreed to buy Orak because it is the most amazing invention ever and worth 10 times the price she agreed to pay for it. There's just one problem. She doesn't have the authority to pay 100 million credits for it. Her plan was to kill Ensor in the spaceship, then wait for Ensor the Elder to die on Aristo and take Orak for herself, not necessarily the Federation. Travis is tasked with getting her to Aristo secretly. No one must know what they're up to. What do you think of the episode?
Well, I will start off with this. When Migat first appears in front of Aven, Villa, and Gan, the first thought that ran through my head was, "Welcome to the Castle Anthrax."
Oh, good point. If she'd had a little bit of more of a habit or something, or that little heady thing, yeah.
And with a name like Migat.
Migat, yeah, I can...
Yeah. Aside from that, not the best Blake episode I've ever seen, but I enjoyed it nonetheless.
I kind of like this one. It's not exactly a deep episode, but it's
a prelude.
Yes. I think we're supposed to wonder what this amazing Orak thing is.
Yeah.
This
was essentially just a prelude. And I don't think knowing, I mean, I've seen the last episode years ago, but going into this, yeah, I think even if I had not seen it, I would have had a good idea that this was merely a prelude to what was coming up in the next episode. So knowing that, or at least realizing that, I was able to think, yeah, I mean, it's not a bad episode. And I think one of the strengths of this, there's some really interesting character development, or character growth, I should say, that we see in this. Two that really come to mind.
I mean, Gan seemed to be really, really branching out in this episode.
Well,
okay, I'm being sarcastic.
I know, yes, you are. Actually, the two that come to mind are Aven and Travis.
I would go so far as to add Servalan to that list.
Possibly.
But
But in terms of Aven, this is the first time we actually see him. Well, I'm going to take that back. Not the first time we've seen him, but because we've seen little bits, little steps. But I think this is the first time there's a full realization that Aven is a part of this crew. He volunteers, I'm guessing.
It does seem like he volunteered, yeah.
It seemed like he wanted to. We don't see it on camera, but when he comes out dressed for the cold weather and he's arming himself, I mean, they're examining the surface conditions. Blake asks Aven, "Are you sure you want to do this?" And Aven, in typical snarky fashion, responds with, why, are you afraid that I'll do a better job than you? And of course, Blake laughs him off and says, no. And Avon's response is, you should be. Now,
yeah.
Snarky responses aside, I was rather impressed with the fact that he appeared to volunteer to do this. And then later, when Jenna is taken, we know that Avon, Villa, and Gan go back down to the planet. And when
That is an odd scene.
Well, what I find interesting is when Avon radios back to Blake, and the last thing that Blake says is, please don't give up on Jenna. And Avon says, don't worry, I don't plan to yet.
Yet. Yeah. There's that delay.
There's a little bit of yet. But still, there was the first part, I don't plan to. And there was something kind of serious in the tone of his voice.
You know, it's more than just that. The scene that gets me is when they've all teleported up, and at least this time, Callie's sort of noticed Jenna's not there, and she's still working the teleport. Even the other three have gone off to the surgical unit. And then when Callie comes and tells them, Blake takes everyone except Callie back to the teleport, and he starts working the teleport frantically. And Avon says, we'll go back down. So Avon volunteers the second time, and now this is the part that's weird. It's Blake's response. I think you better.
Yeah.
As if it was Avon almost like screwed
Avon's,
up.
Yeah, it was like it was Avon's fault. And not really.
But this is one other thing. The expression on his face when he teleports down, Avon looks like he thinks it's his fault.
Possibly.
He's certainly not, that's not his cool, cold exterior. That's a furrowed look.
Yeah.
You know, is he concerned for Jenna, or is this Blake demonstrating, no, you didn't do a better job than me after all?
I think it might be a bit of both. It might be a mixture. But what I do get a good sense of, this is the first time, again, I got to take that back, not the first time, but now we really get this realization of this Avon's united team.
Avon's in on the action.
Yeah.
He's working on behalf of the team here.
And there's no doubt, I mean, in the past, it had always been adversarial. I mean, he would go along with whatever it was begrudgingly, although we would see in bits and steps and just a little bit here, a little bit there, these instances where he, say, you know, save Blake's life or do something on the behalf of the ship and the crew. But always there was that vocal resistance that Avon would always kind of blurt out. And we're not getting that so much this time. I mean, we still get Avon, snarky Avon, but we're not getting this, okay, I'm only doing this just this one time kind of thing. I mean, now he really feels like a part of the crew.
I'll throw this out here. I'd never previously thought about it until just exactly this moment, because I still largely consider, we've kind of vaguely mentioned this, that Blake Seven has a bit of a story arc in places. It's not at the level that you see in something like Babylon 5 or the convoluted mess that we see in Doctor Who these days, but there's a thin edge of evolution for Bohr, particularly Blake's character. But there's nothing yet, anyway, that you can mark as a defining moment, that you can put against his character. It's just sort of a progression. Mm-hmm. And the last episode, or if not the last episode, which didn't really feature Avon in it much, but the previous episode was Breakdown. That's the one where Avon basically ditched them.
Right.
And was offering to sell up their technology to the Federation for his freedom, and then he had to make that choice. He made the choice at the end of Breakdown to join back up with the Liberator and go with them. Could that be the deciding moment here that we're now looking at post-decision Avon? He had his chance to leave, and he didn't.
Good point. Very, very good point. That might be it.
And it's kind of a shame that it wasn't the previous episode and that they threw Bounty in there.
It would have made this one look better.
He threw Bounty in there to kind of throw you off, which is, as we said, quite the filler of an episode.
I mean, that you make a really good point there. And had Bounty,
I just
and
pulled that
Breakdown,
out of my,
but it's a good head. One.
There,
you pulled that out of thin air, but it's a very good point. It would have been interesting to see what would have happened had these two episodes been reversed. I mean, there's no reason why they couldn't have been that I could see.
Yeah, there's nothing. I mean, story wise, there's nothing here that's had to be Bohr after Breakdown. But we did actually have that moment where Avon was gone and now he's back in Breakdown, and so maybe there actually was a plan.
I mean there was no payoff of Avon's return that we could see in Bounty. Bounty. We're getting it now, yeah, possibly. So. The other development or other character growth of a sort was Travis, and it's solely in the scene where Servalon is talking to Travis, and she mentions.
You mean the one where he's standing at attention and not being?
No, actually, well, no, see, that's, well, that was interesting. That was very interesting.
To me, I know where you're going here, but that scene where he comes in and he's standing there, and she's intentionally just typing randomly on something in front of her to ignore him, which is kind of a mirror of the first time we see Travis, where he's told to wait, and this time he's not told to wait; she's ignoring him, and then we get a heck of a lot of exposition on her part explaining how, well, you wouldn't have taken that a few months ago from anybody, not even me. Obviously you're this and you're a broken man, or are you a broken man, and why didn't you resign? And so I mean, we really get an info dump, and what I didn't like about that info dump is that we're supposed to see growth and the change, if you will, in the character of Travis, but instead of showing it to us, they info dumped it to us.
Well, the part that I was actually kind of interested in was
later
when
with Marriott or the
when, yeah
or
when Servalon tells him that Marriott went along on this mission. And this is the second time we've actually seen Travis show any kind of concern for other people, especially since Marriott is the one who saved his life.
There's the friend that should have been in the tree with him.
Yeah, that would have been interesting instead of the mutoid. It would have been very interesting to see Marriott in there. And he even shows some concern because Servalon says that Marriott's going to be branded a deserter of the Federation.
Mm-hmm.
And Travis says, well, his family, they're going to suffer for this.
They're
going to be punished.
You want to clarify that for the listeners out there. You know, it's one thing if your family thinks you're a deserter and you run off and they're all sad.
They're going to be punished for it.
The law in the Federation is that you get turned into slaves and shipped off to an outer colony.
Right.
So, you know,
all because of Servalon's desire to get Orak.
Mm-hmm.
It's all part of this elaborate scheme. And here's a case where Servalon clearly has the ends justifying the means. Travis, not so much. He's a little resistant only because Marriott did save his life. And
this
now Marriott
is dead.
This is
what he needs to do to get his command back, and this is what he needs to do to get Blake.
Exactly. And he's going along with it begrudgingly because when he mentions, you know, Marriott's family, they're going to be punished for it. And Servalon, she does go on, you know, well, you know, this is the Federation policy, blah, 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 blah. Do you have a problem with that?
And his
answer is, no, only Blake matters.
Now. Yeah.
Now.
He's only Blake matters now.
But I still get that sense of, and this is a tip of the hat to Stephen Graff, that's his name, right? The actor?
I think it's pronounced Grief, but G-R-I-E-F.
Maybe it is Grief. He says it in such a way that it has certain layers to it, which I really like, because it makes Travis a little more than just this two-dimensional villain, which he really ran the risk of becoming.
Yeah, there's a little bit of regret there, but there's recognition that it's too late anyway.
There's nothing he can do about it. He's got to go along
with it. And it's part of the thing. But I think the line that's actually more telling in his case is when he says, you know, I think you're as ruthless as I am,
yeah,
Supreme Commander. Now, that's an interesting line, because he's clearly interpreting her as more ruthless than he is, and he's trying to put himself in her class in his mind. I'm just that ruthless. But we can see from his expression, no, he isn't.
No, he's not. He realizes that she's far more cutthroat than he is.
And, of course, her comment about, well, then you underestimate me is, you know, just
factual. And he acknowledged it.
I'm beginning to learn that, yes. But now here's my thing. We've seen Servalon not necessarily as a cipher. We've obviously seen that she likes to play with her boy toys there at Space Command, that she does not necessarily have the trust and or the ear of the president. That even they may be somewhat adversarial, the military versus the civilian government. And we have seen her set up Travis to take the fall instead of her in the event that the Blake thing doesn't go the way that everyone needs it. But we have not, till this point, seen her in full-on devious mode.
No, I think this is the first time.
And this one clearly shows us that she's interested in more than the good of the Federation. She's interested in the good of Servalon.
Mm-hmm.
Because I get out of this, this deal that she's cutting. This is not, I'm cutting corners to get Aurak, and then, woo-hoo, the Federation's going to be all so happy with me for doing this.
No.
This is all I'm cutting corners to get Aurak for herself, which she sees as some sort of power device.
Right, it's a power grab. She sees this as a means of elevating her position in the Federation.
Which, possibly, considering she's the supreme commander of the military, there aren't too many more positions to move into.
No, I mean, she has the military might, she has the military authority, but she has no real political power. This could put her in a position where she could have that political power.
Or more.
I mean, you know, she could probably see herself not just as the supreme commander of the military, but also possibly president of the Federation. I mean, and now that's a really scary situation to have that duality.
I don't even think that's what I would picture. I would think she's looking for, and I use the word empress just simply because it's a conquest, not a, you know, there's the illusion, whether or not it's true or not, that the president is an elected official.
Well, yes.
It may be sham elections that drugged people only have one party, but there's the illusion that that is the president. But then there is also, when the military takes over, then you're
right.
Lord Emperor of Doom,
right,
or whatever,
right,
it happens
I agree.
To be.
I agree. It is a power grab for supreme power of,
yes,
the Federation, or whatever organization it would become under her reign.
Right.
And Aurak is clearly the means to achieve that.
Something that's worth a billion credits in her mind.
And yet she's will, and then she sells out, or not sells out, but she sacrifices Enzor and Mariat just for the sake of getting her hands on Aurak and not have to worry about spending the money. I mean, that's really shrewd.
Okay, here's my problem with this. There is one problem with this scheme. When the show opens, we see Enzor and Mariat in the ship, and they're coming across Cephalon, and they're using it as some sort of beacon, turning point, or something of that nature. And Mariat, who's, we don't know anything about him at the time, is saying to Enzor, "So, where are we going?"
Man,
and Enzor goes, "I'm not telling you. It's we've been living complete secret for 30 years, and it's not. It's, it doesn't matter now. We're on the way." And it's like, not telling you. And then they blow up and they crash on the planet. How is it exactly that Servalan is supposed to know where Aristo is, or where Enzor Sr. is? If her plan works, she blows up the ship before they get there. She waits a couple weeks for Enzor Sr. to die. But if you don't know where he died, how are you going to
find him?
Get him?
Yeah.
You know, it'd be different if it was like a bug on Mariat, and Enzor said, "Yeah, we're going to Aristo. I don't see any reason it would hurt you now." And then she was in her headquarters and go, "Right, that's what I needed. Blow up the ship."
That's absolutely true, because she even mentions to Travis when he comes in,
"We've never been able to find
him." No, we've never been able to find Enzor Senior, I think.
Yeah.
They're both called
Enzor.
Yeah, we've never known where he's at. We've heard that he was working on this thing called Aurak. We've had no proof. We don't know where he's at. And now here's the link. But yeah, killing
Before he even gets there,
it seems like not the smartest plan.
I would definitely wait till they were on an orbital approach to a planet, and then blow him up.
Unless she assumes Cephalon was the planet.
In which case, she's going to be sorely disappointed when she looks for Aurak.
That's true. That's the
only
thing
there.
I can think of. No. It's the only thing I can think of. I mean, other than that, she has no reason to know. I don't think there was even any. Did they even mention at the end of this episode that they were going to Aristo?
Yes. Enzor Jr. Did finally mention the name after he gave the
well,
coordinates.
Well, to Blake, yeah. To Liberator. But I'm wondering if Servalan ever mentioned it.
Not that.
I don't remember her ever saying it.
I don't remember her saying the name, no. We're going to go, you know, we just wait for Enzor to die and then we go collect Aurak
on
our own.
It's
like,
where? So they have no idea. And to the best of her knowledge.
Good thing she's got Travis.
Well, yeah, but she has no evidence at this point. I mean, the only reason she's got Travis is to help retrieve Aurak. She knows nothing about Blake's involvement.
Yeah,
at this point.
Travis is just a fixer. He's there to get the ship, hide the ship, keep them a secret, protect her, act as a strong man if she needs him. You know, he's a
tool.
A tool, that's right. He knows he's a tool, so
yeah,
it's okay. But that did bug me when I watched it through this time. I said, wait a minute, she doesn't know where she's going.
No, yeah, it was a rather annoying plot hole.
But yeah, I thought she was, we see the boost of Servalan, and it's just a shame that since we're coming to the end of the series here, and you know how they are, they'll probably kill her. So Oh, gosh. Don't give us spoilers.
Spoilers.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear. Or maybe not. I don't know. All right. Let's see. So we had that annoying A plot, B plot thing again.
Kind of.
The
yeah.
B plot being just to kill some time. In Doctor Who.
I'm so glad you brought that up.
In the olden days, in Doctor Who. Right, Tom Baker, Liz Sladen, and Adam Leela, and all those people.
Dadgummit, we liked it.
There is that notion that said, you know, the thing about having the Doctor and a companion is you can split them up and you can tell two stories. But whenever they tell two stories, they're telling two connected stories, two threads, parallel threads that are leading inevitably to one story conclusion. But when, and you know, the more you have a cast, if you add Adric and Tegan and Nyssa and the Doctor, and then you've got more people than you know what to do with, one of them has to get sick and leave them behind, or you pair them up in funny pairs, or however it has to go to fit the number of threads that you work your way around to think. But when Blake Seven, and Terry Nation has done this consistently, these two threads don't really have a whole lot to do with one another.
No, they don't.
In this case, they're just killing time with Blake and Callie, with Ensor holding her on the floor with a gun to her head. And
well, that's interesting you bring that up, because I found that to at least be the more relevant of the storylines that were happening here. I mean, I saw that. I was able to kind of forgive it because...
It's the excuse to keep them from rescuing Blake or Avon and group before they get a chance to do Deliverance. So if
true.
You're thinking of the story as Deliverance, the story is actually about Avon saving those people. And
but
the rest
see,
of it is...
I keep looking as not so much what's happening with Migat and Castle Anthrax as the whole Deliverance thing, even though they refer to it in a very literal sort of way. I kept looking to what was happening on Liberator and seeing that as more of the through storyline. I mean, and you're right. I mean, it is kind of filler, but I forgave it. Because
it's not the worst of the bunch.
No,
it
isn't.
By far.
And it still serves as some kind of a prelude to what's yet to come. So... knowing that, I was able to leave it alone. What bothered me is what's happening on Cephalon.
It's
that storyline drove me mental because it felt totally irrelevant to the mission that the Liberator was on. They were there to try to find out what was this ship. Well, who are its passengers? What is this Aurak thing that they're that Ensor's talking about? Well, at least that's Avon really doesn't really know all much about it, but
yeah.
More concerned about what these two passengers are. And oh, great. Now we're caught up in this little weird conflict. And now we've got this wacky high priestess who thinks I'm a lord. Terrific. And then this whole bit about the gene bank. And it just felt irrelevant.
I thought that, inconsistent with your observation, that this was a story about Avon growth and volunteering. This is a different... this is another opportunity for Avon to be in charge, for Avon to run things his way. And I think this played out very differently than if... well, I think the end result would have been the same if Blake had been the person going down there. But, we wouldn't have gotten the mileage from the girl worshipping Blake in the same way. That's really... that's what this story is about, is to give you the opportunity to watch, frankly, the delightful scenes of her worshiping Avon dealing with that in his strange, smug, arrogant kind of way, and to watch Villa not be happy about it at all.
Well, you make a good point. What I would go even further to say is, then that story needed to have its own episode. Totally.
It's, you know, Terry Nation, he can't write a story long
I
enough
know.
To fill. So
I know. And instead, it got it was really trimmed down
into another type,
it felt like more filler because it wasn't given the really great development that I think it could have deserved and possibly could have been turned into a very strong story.
You know, it's funny. You have, in the past, we have had stories where the A plot, B plot occur on planet and Liberator, and the unlike Star Trek, in Star Trek, when you need to strand them on the planet, you just break transporter. In Blake Seven, when you need to strand them on the planet, you have to get the Liberator off station. So somebody's always kidnapping the ship or flying it off or taking somewhere. And typically, you are following a story that the A plot is on the planet, and they need, you know, not to have the magic bullet of, oh, just beam me up. So they get the Liberator out of the way, and to get the Liberator out of the way, they have to run this little B plot on the Liberator. But this one is actually in reverse, in a way. They still have to get the Liberator away to make the planetary plot work, but finally, they have a story where the Liberator is away that actually will have some bearing on the next episode. So I think it's a much better balance between the two. And if Terry Nation is going to continue in this sort of two-story mode, this is one of the better ones that he's done in respect.
Possibly. I think my problem personally with this is I didn't care. The story on Cephalon regarding Megat and Deliverance, there was not enough there. I mean, I was amused a little bit with the whole worshipping of Lord Avon, but they were not giving us enough in that story in terms of detail that allowed for me to invest in it emotionally. I found myself more curious with what was happening on Liberator, only because I knew that Ensor Jr. has some connection to this Aurak thing that Servalan is so crazy about.
If we hadn't seen Servalan, would the Aurak thing be as interesting a storyline? Or would it just be a MacGuffin to get him trying to...
It would have been a MacGuffin at that point. The fact that Servalan, she treats Aurak as the smoking gun with the way that it's brought up. It becomes the smoking gun in the room. Now, I have to know what this thing is. If it had just been the MacGuffin, then I would totally agree with you. Everything happening on the Liberator would be a complete waste. I'd find myself a little bit more interested with what's happening on the planet. In fact, I probably would have then been very, very irritated at the fact that we had this storyline happening on Liberator, because then I'd really want to know what's happening on the planet.
So Terry Nation's gotten to be a better scriptwriter. He's improved his style. So I want to talk, even though you don't like the plot down on the planet, I want to talk about it because you know, we discussed the character growth of Avon in his mode as I'm volunteering to go down. I'll go back and save Jenna. I'm not going to leave without Jenna kind of mode. That's all good and dandy. But there is something going on here with his character with regards to the worship by Megat. He is not offended, as far as I can tell, by her behavior. He seems a bit entranced by her.
He certainly seemed that way. He actually even showed what appeared to be a little bit of tenderness towards her.
Exactly. More than once.
Yeah.
But he's obviously loving...
Oh, he's so
lording it up over Villa. The line where Villa says, "Well, why him?" And Avon, Gan knows. It's funny in that scene. Gan is looking at Megat. Megat is looking at Avon, and Villa is just kind of like, "Ooh, why isn't it me?"
Yeah.
And it's so obvious. It's not that Megat is. It's not that Megat. She's a woman, and she's decided that Avon is the dishy one. I mean, I think that's all. It literally is. I think guys walked through the door and she picked the one she liked the look of.
Possibly.
First and foremost. And she's just standing there staring at Avon and looking at him, and Avon's looking back at her and can see that. Gan's looking at the two of them, and he's clearly seeing it going on between the two of them, and Villa's oblivious to it, and he's like, "Well, why isn't me?" And Avon's like, "Well, you are hardly the stuff gods are made of," which
True.
Is just a
but I
bad
think that,
line.
I think it also speaks to Avon's character. Whether he was feeling like a part of the crew or not, regardless of where his loyalties fully lied, at any point during this series, he always carried himself with a sense of a certain self-assuredness that the moment he'd walked into a room, you couldn't help but notice him. It's just the way he carries himself. I mean, we always talk about that whenever we see him walk onto the screen. You know, maybe it's because we know of Paul Darrow and his work, and we just love seeing how he can play the part. But even, I think even not knowing that, the moment you see him, you can't help but notice him. It's just the way he carries himself. And I would go so far as to say that Megat sees that in Avon as well. He has that sense of leadership. He has that sense of command. And she spots it.
And not once in this episode is there any evidence that Avon contemplated not saving them. Nor is there any indication that it was either Gan or Villa's suggestion that we have to save these people. Avon just, they think I'm going to save them, and I can do it.
He does it, you get the feeling he's doing it for her.
Yeah, I do it. Okay, yeah. Fine. I mean, here, we'll just flip this stuff on and we'll launch the rocket, and okay, no problem.
And and he's not doing it out of 100% vanity either.
No, he's being nice.
He's being
the hero.
He is. Now, I would say that his ego was definitely being stroked. There's no question about it. He even admits it. But yep. possibly she, but by pushing that button in him, maybe given the growth that he has had so far in the series, maybe he's being more honest with himself in terms of, I'm not really that kind of a bad guy, you know?
But okay, but there's one more. There's one more line here in this story that speaks a lot. After going through this whole thing and, you know, and he totally accepts her thing. And it's unclear to me whether or not he accepts it because, hey, pretty girl is paying attention to me. That's obviously that's part of it. But it's also expedient to do so. I mean, somebody puts you in a position of power over them. He gets the information on how to go find Jenna. He gets her to recite all the stories and the prophecies about her people. You know, he doesn't have to argue. He doesn't have to do anything. He gets what he wants in this episode. He's not abusing her in any way. I mean, he's not cheating her, but he definitely could tell her, I'm not. I mean, Blake probably would. I'm just a man. But I think Gan tries that. Gan or Villa tries that at one point in this episode, but she won't hear it. Now, if Aven had said it to her, maybe you should have believed it. But at the end, after he launches the gene bank, she says some line about, you know, I as you know, there's nothing for you in it launching the gene bank, but that I was the one who was here when you came. And he says, that seems a poor reward somehow. And that is a very self-deprecating comment. It's not exactly self-deprecating, but he's taking the pin out of himself right there. It's like, that ain't worth it. You waiting all your whole life just for me to show up for a few hours and do this wasn't worth it in his own mind.
Well,
unless he then takes her and gives her one before they leave, say, okay, well, that'll make it worth it for you.
Well, I don't believe that happened.
What happened to her? Seriously, what happened to the girl?
She probably just stayed behind and died.
We just cut that line, and the next thing you're up on the Liberator, because Blake said, we'll be there in 4 hours, right?
Yeah.
And then basically cut, and then they're on the Liberator doing the debriefing. So what kind of farewell was there with Mika in four hours? What kind
who
of,
knows?
You know, what did they do? They send her back to her village, apparently, and say, there you go, bye-bye, you guys can all die now, because that's what's going to happen.
Should we say there was, what, there was 100 of them?
Yeah. And they were fewer every year. They're dying off.
Yeah.
It's a dead world. We know that. There's no saving any of those people. So what happened?
You know, that's kind of what I was getting
out of it
in terms of her line when she says, you know, I got to be the one to witness this, et cetera, you know, and Avon's response seems like a poor reward. I kind of got the feeling that it was a statement of saying, yes, the future of your people have been saved. You got to be the one to witness it. But now what do you have left? Now you're going to die.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I got out of the line when he said seems like a poor reward. And to me, that it wasn't like he was being kind of self-deprecating or taking the pin out of himself. It's more like he was really it felt like to me he analyzed the situation, analyzed her future, shall we say, and realized you got nothing ahead of you now. What a poor, you know, that's not a reward. I mean, okay, you got to witness the future of your people, but
think of all the ones who waited their entire lives and died and never even got there.
Right.
I mean,
And
so she has quote unquote nothing, but none of them had anything.
Right.
Really.
Exactly. So. And even then, what little bit that she got feels like a very poor exchange, because while her people, in terms of the gene bank, are going to survive, her future is pretty grim. And I that's what I felt Avon was implying when he said, seems like a poor reward.
Could be. I don't really have anything else. I thought those survival capsules, I thought that was a clever idea. I mean, obviously it's a very cheap special effect. You know, we have trying to look at the technology of space travel. We have had for years the idea of pods. Look at Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the escape pod from the rebel ship at the very beginning of the thing. It's carrying on of the lifeboat. But
This
seems like a much more practical kind of, you know, it's a little tiny spaceship. There's not much room. I mean, it's barely bigger than a lifeboat itself. And we've developed this thing where you could fall all the way from the atmosphere and land on the ground. That's actually kind of a clever idea.
I was a little concerned, but when I guess it was Callie was the one who was describing, was it Callie or Jenna?
I was describing how
those capsules work, how they're basically shock resistant.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, okay, I mean, It creates a situation where I have to kind of wave my hand and think, okay, that's some pretty advanced tech. But, you know, you made the claim, I'll accept it. You made the statement, this is what they do, this is how they operate. Okay, you put it out there, I'll buy it. And yeah, I thought it was a really great idea. It's a nice, I'm glad they addressed it.
And it's a cheap special effect.
Well, it is a very cheap special effect, but at least they addressed it, because I kept wondering about life pods and escape pods that would have these landings, and just imagine they've got to be, unless there's some kind of retro rocket system that would allow for it to have a very soft touchdown, I would imagine that the landing would be unbelievably rough,
mm-hmm.
that it could be more fatal than staying on board the ship. So for them to bring that up, that nice little bit of technology, and say, yeah, you could fall from the edge of the atmosphere and not even get a scratch, I thought, okay, you know, bravo for at least addressing that.
Yeah, it would be the kind, I don't know if you remember this. There was this back in the 70s or early 80s, I guess it was, they had the space shuttle operator's manual. You remember that?
Yes, I do, actually.
The technical manual, whatever they called it. It was, and I remember that Starlog magazine was advertising, they're not advertising, but they were reviewing it or talking about it being available. And they had a picture from one of the pages in it. And it was about the, I don't remember what they're called now, but they were the rescue balls that they had. And it showed how to deploy one of these things. So it was drawings of the person taking it out of the pouch and unfolding it, and then they unzip it, right? And they take their little air supply or whatever it was, and they crawl into the bubble, and they crunch down in a thing. And then the last frame of that cartoon light thing is have another crew member zip you up. And I thought that was just the most hilarious thing, is that you have an escape system that requires one person to stay behind and zip everybody else up. And first off, what would you do with them? If you're up in space in the space shuttle and you're in these little canvas sacks and they push you out into space, how is that going to help you? But I think of that whenever I think of, and it turns out that there was supposed to be something for the last person to do. And when you read the whole technical manual, there was an explanation. It was like, we have room to save two people and the other four get left in orbit until we can come pick them up, or some nutty configuration like that. And so it wasn't as bad as it, and it's still bad, but it was like, what do you do? It feels like the kind of thing that somebody designing a spaceship, I mean, these pods, would be like, what's the cheapest, easiest way that we can try to save somebody in a orbital disaster? And, you know, NASA goes, canvas sack. But in Blake 7, it's sort of a big peanut shell that you launch at it. I think that's all we've got on this episode, right?
Pretty much. I mean, that pretty much covers it. I felt this was more of a character-driven episode than plot-driven, which is probably why I liked it as much as I did.
So, no spoilers. No spoilers. Actually, genuinely no spoilers. But the next episode is called Orak. So we may be addressing what is Orak. And I am going to tell the listeners that, you know, go watch the episodes that you can hear us talk about it. Before you watch it, think about it. The name Orak is a clue. In the meantime, Ben, thank you for joining me.
Oh, a pleasure as always.
And listeners, I hope you'll join us again next time on Fusion Patrol.
Cheers.
Fusion Patrol is a Lone Locust production. Like us, leave us a review on iTunes, or stop by and visit at our website, fusionpatrol.com. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, search for Fusion Patrol, or just drop us a note at feedback@fusionpatrol.com. Our music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.